Well, good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is David Abramson. I'm the Deputy Director of Columbia's National Center for Disaster Preparedness. You heard a little bit about it from Jonathan, so I'm not going to go into more details on that. And what I'm going to talk about today has been in part eclipsed by the events of the past 2 to 3 days, at least in New York and along the eastern seaboard it has. So I'm certainly not going to ignore the fact that we've had an issue in the past couple of days. I have no financial disclosures. This is what New York City looked like at the beginning of last night when it went dark. They lost power. There are a couple of buildings that still had it, but obviously, you know, this was a serious, one of the most serious events and storms to hit the eastern seaboard and certainly New York City. This is a picture down on the lower Manhattan. This is one of the subway stations at 86th Street. And if you can imagine how much water is going to have to be pumped out of the subway system in order to make it work, this does have public health implications, which I will get to in a minute. This is a picture of Breezy Point, where there were 80 to 100 houses lost in an area in Queens. And so this raises the question, okay, so this was a huge event for New York City, the surrounding counties, certainly the surrounding states, a massive event. What does public health do in events like this? Are we in a position as public health of emergency first response? And if so, what exactly are we doing? Who's doing it? Are we ready to do it? So when you look at ESF8, the Emergency Support Function 8, the federal roles and responsibilities as delineated, you know, there's a whole laundry list of things that public health is responsible for. And in some ways, many of the states, many of the localities have tried to mirror this requirement list that comes out from the Fed so that they are sure that they can manage or oversee or delegate these kind of roles and responsibilities. And maybe I should ask, so I know at least a little bit better who I'm talking to, how many people in this room have operated at some point in their career in public health emergency response? So I get just a sense. Okay, so a number of you already know this. At least half of you know this, and the other half probably are aware of it. A lot of times the things on this list, though, come as a bit of a surprise, whether it's mortuary and mass fatality, whether it's veterinary, whether it's assuring supply chains that you weren't really thinking of beforehand. And so when you have something like this and then a Hurricane Sandy occurs, you have a series of, and these are real-time decisions that are being made today, that were being made yesterday, that will be being made in the next couple of days. The coordination of hospital and nursing home evacuees, obviously that was happening over the past couple of days. During Hurricane Irene, there was a mandatory evacuation of hospital facilities. This time, not so much. Fewer evacuations. That may prove to be a decision point that's going to be revisited. There was a wastewater treatment plant release in one of the counties, I think it was down in Maryland, that I saw the pictures on CNN, and that's obviously going to raise public health issues of food and water safety and environmental hazards. There's all sorts of home flooding, and then there's the question of mold remediation and how much public health can come in and begin to help people understand what they have to do to maintain a healthy environment. The power outages obviously are going to lead to a number of issues that are public health issues. Food safety inspections are high on that list. Bioterror monitoring stations. In New York City, when the blackout of 2003 occurred, a lot of the monitoring stations that existed around the city went down in the blackout, and they had to immediately go to secondary sources and private labs in order to assure that the bioterror sniffing devices were still operational. So there are all these sort of secondary effects and cascading effects that have to be taken care of. And then there's supply chain issues. Just as an example, in Westchester County, which is a county of about 1 million population just north of New York City, there are a dozen nursing homes today without power, 2 hospitals on generator. 1 hospital has no access to medical charts. 2,000 nursing home patients are either in the dark or on generator right now. New York City Coney Island Hospital had a fire on the 3rd floor, and many of you may have seen the pictures of NYU being evacuated after the storm had hit. Which leads me to the case study of Hurricane Irene. What I came up here to talk about, not really Sandy, but it has some implication, I would like to think. So Irene made landfall on August 26th, and we conducted from our center a survey of the public health workforce several weeks later, within about a month after the event. So this shows the path of historical hurricanes that have hit the New York City area. The first point to note is there aren't many of them. So New York, the New York area, is not really well prepared for hurricanes because it's not something that we tend to see very much of. When they do hit, they tend to have a huge impact, but some of them are years and years ago. Carol 1954, Donna 1960, 76, Gloria in 85. So thinking about the last presentation, there isn't a lot of institutional memory that's going to help you. Now there will be for Sandy, from Irene, but there wasn't for Irene. So this is a picture of Irene as it came up, of the modeling as it began to the forecast of what the path would be. And it turns out that the forecast was remarkably accurate in the tracking, although it was not as accurate in the strength or intensity. So the forecasters were quite accurate in saying this is where the storm will hit, but they were saying it was going to be a Category 1, maybe even a slim possibility of a 2, but certainly a Category 1 hurricane. It wasn't. It ended up hitting land, became a tropical storm. The effects, though, were undeniable. There's a tremendous amount of flooding, both in the city and north of the city and in other states as well. And so this led us to look to our participating public health partners, and you heard from the last presenters that we have a number of partners in this 28-county catchment area that our center serves. And what we did was we essentially went to all of them and said, we would like to survey your entire public health workforce, whether or not they were deployed during Hurricane Irene, in order to understand what did they do, what were their job functions, what were their roles, what were their responsibilities, and how prepared were they? Those are the questions. So in order to launch this, we did this through the county's emergency preparedness coordinators, and they in turn split it between the public health workforce and the medical reserve corps, so we could pick up both the institutions within the county agencies themselves as well as the volunteers that comprise their physician and nurse and medical reserve corps. So we ended up surveying 1,493 individuals who work in public health, so I'm leaving aside the Medical Reserve Corps. Of those, 54% responded to Irene. Amongst those who responded the first weekend, because it was a fairly protracted event, they were 44%. 44% were asked to respond, 660, and of those 660, 609 of them responded on the first weekend, and about 390 responded on the first Saturday and Sunday of the event. Most of the people who responded out of the total were public health agency employees. We asked about whether they got overtime pay, because this in the past has been at least a question that came up from a lot of our partners is how do we handle, especially off hours, are we going to be dealing with a lot of overtime pay? And the answer was not so much. Only 10% of the people who worked, only 10% of the total actually received the overtime pay. When we looked about how much time they worked, we saw that on average, most people were only working, 8 to 10 hour days, so they weren't working double shifts or anything. These were at least, reasonable amount of time for them to go in, cover a shift, get some rest, and come back for second shifts. And we asked about their ability and willingness to report to work. And so of the 1,400 that we surveyed, 59% did not respond at all. And the reason they didn't respond was they were not asked to report, and that was a large proportion of them. 62% were not asked to respond. But then others, 18% of those who did not respond, said they had other people dependent upon them, kids or elders, and they could not respond. 13% were on vacation or out of town, and that actually turned out to be a significant thing. This was just close to Labor Day weekend, and the people who were out of town on this Labor Day weekend and on vacation were more likely to be seniors, senior managers, senior supervisors, senior staff. So a lot of the top of the agency was not available at that initial time frame. When you look at the side of who responded, two-thirds of the people basically expected to be at work. They didn't have to be asked. They didn't volunteer as so much as they just said, I have to be there. I'm expected to be there, and they were there. 12% were asked to work voluntarily. 6% were ordered to report, and 15% volunteered even though they had not been asked. So in terms of what work settings did this public health workforce go to in that first weekend, or the first 4 days of Hurricane Irene. So 6.5% were deployed to hospitals. 20% were telecommuting, meaning they were trying to keep track of what was going on from wherever they were and coordinating efforts away from their home base. 29% were deployed to work in shelters. 20% were deployed to work in the field, which could be, many of these folks were environmental inspectors and food sanitarians, etc. 30% worked in the EOC, and about 30% ended up working in the office, not that office, an office. And so we wanted to look at how this matches up with the CDC public health emergency preparedness capabilities, because if you think about it, the CDC has put anywhere between $5 to $8 billion since 9/11 into public health emergency preparedness. The CDC in particular has put about $350 million into institutions like ours, academic public health schools, to train the public health workforce. And what they've asked us to train the public health workforce in is they want them to be competent, and they've given us a list of competencies that they've asked to make sure that the workforce is competent. And now they have a new thing where they say that we want them to be capable. They have to be able to perform very specific functions. And very soon, the funding that health departments will get will be tied to these FEP capabilities. And so they're broken into these large areas of surge management, incident management, countermeasures and mitigation, biosurveillance, information management, and the very loosely defined community resilience. And so when we look at where did people work for this incident, and they could work in multiple places, by the way, so these are not going to add up to 100%. Close to half worked in the EOC or under that, not in it, but using that capability. That's what they were doing. Almost half were working in the field of mass care. Over half were in surveillance and epi investigation. And about a third were in emergency public information and warning. A little over a quarter in information sharing. The other areas up there all were very few responses to that, at least for the hurricane. So these were the major areas that people were focused on. And so what we looked at then was, what was the relationship between the training they had received and how effective they felt it was? And so we looked at did they feel prepared by prior training? So if you look at emergency operations coordination, most people felt prepared by that. Most people felt prepared with their surveillance and EPI and the public information sharing, but not so much on the mass care. There was also a lot of just-in-time training that occurred, and we said, did people feel prepared by the just-in-time training for the functional roles that they were doing? And most of them felt that that just-in-time training was not addressing, you know, the specific preparation they needed for their functional roles. So with this, we try to create a measure that we call the measure of unmet need for training, which was equal to really the reciprocal of training exposure, 1 minus training exposure, times the training efficacy, meaning how much training did you get and how effective was it? If you got very little training and the little training you got was not very effective, you would have a high unmet need. If you got a lot of training and it was very effective, you would not have a high unmet need. You would have met need. And so we've mapped this out, and this is a little bit hard to see. But what we did was we broke it down by the level of provider. So we were looking at, we looked at administrative staff, the mid-level workforce, and senior management. And if you look at here, this would be the administrative, and the side is showing you what the domains are. You could see that there's a lot of variation on the met or unmet need that they had. So the administrative staff felt that there was very little unmet need for them for the public health surveillance and EPI, but they felt a high need to have more training in emergency operations coordination. The good news, perhaps, on the senior level, up here, is that, there's good news and bad news. The bad news is there's a high amount of unmet need. The good news is it's all clustered together, so they need everything. There was also a difference by states. And so we looked at New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, and we found that there was a difference state by state. And so this could help guide further development of training and hopefully, you know, be used to prepare agencies for something like a Hurricane Sandy.